culture here in Hunterdon. It was a very rural agrarian community at one point, and many places still is. And
well, it's evidenced by the amount of hunting clubs that exist here in Hunterdon County, and our grandparents were the charter members of one such hunting club.
Yes, and let me explain the hunting club just a little bit for, because I know there's people who probably listen to this podcast may have come to Hunterdon more recently and don't understand the origins. There would be, because hunting goes over large areas, and sometimes you have a lot of land, you know, or a good amount of land, but you might not have a whole as much land as you need, because deer don't necessarily respect, you know,
boundaries
or any kind of wild game for that matter. So if you're out hunting and you say, hit a deer, or you've been stalking a deer or another piece of game, but I'm just going to use a deer as an example, that deer may actually wander onto somebody else's property. So people get together in groups and say, we agree to respect and hunt on each other's property, but respect that property while we're doing it during, you know, the appropriate season. And so they would gather together in groups, and those people would be known as landowners. And then there'd be other people who would say, hey, I don't have property, or I live in a city, but I enjoy hunting. I want to hunt on those lands too, can I? And then they would could become members of that organization. And some of these built clubhouses, and there are clubhouses throughout the area. And they're still used, and they're a good place to gather and talk. And sometimes they have a bar, or they have a pool table, or some other things. And they have picnics, and they hang out together. So it's kind of a cool thing.
That's right. And it doesn't just include just the hunting piece. There's the fishing piece as well. So
Yeah, a lot of them are rod and gun clubs.
Correct.
So they might be fishing in that stream off of somebody else's property, or they might have a nice group trip to, like, a major fishing spot, you know. So it's actually really a very cool thing. So I know some people are concerned when they hear that there is a gun club in their backyard or nearby. And it's nothing to be afraid of. It's just people engaging in field-to-fork as a recreational practice and possibly an ecological practice as well.
That's right. Well, that's not all we have on tap for today. Obviously, there was some history made this morning around 9 a.m. Eastern Time. We've been talking about space, and we've been covering space since the beginning of our podcast back in January, because we feel that that is the new... It is a new genre. It is a new business. It'll be interesting to see how space business evolves moving forward. If you are a business person or a student of business... It's very interesting, or you just like space, and, you know, you see all your sci-fi fantasies coming to fruition.
Or you could actually personally live those sci-fi fantasies. You could enter to win in a drawing to win a ticket, or you could
make a lot of money, then purchase a ticket.
Yes, win the lottery, and then go visit space for, you know, a few minutes, and...
I don't know if it justifies a price for a few minutes of... I mean... I don't know. I think a ticket to Great Adventure is cheaper.
Not by much these days.
You go to free fall and you can, like, float in the air there for a few seconds. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't particularly enjoy that sensation. So I guess Blue Origin's
you can get your
spaceship
G's
would
on.
Not be. So. Yeah. So
it looks like. So we'll get to the space case in a little bit. It looks like.
You're going
to
welcome our guest.
And
You know what? In fact, I'm going to just skip ahead. We're going to talk about this, but we're going to talk about this anyway, is the 10 office hacks to get your home office organized now. So this is a little something I thought about a couple of weeks ago. I thought, you know, there's so many people of us working from home. Why not talk a little bit about the home office? And, you know, you don't want, if you've just brought your home your work into your home in the last year, 18 months or so, things might be looking a little, you know, a little bit cluttered around your house. Maybe you've, you know, given up a dining room or a guest bedroom or, you know, or your living room. So I thought there's probably a lot of people out there who now need some organizational tips to help them with their office situation that they've got going on in their home. Not all of us have a dedicated space. I do have a dedicated space, but it's gotten so out of control that I'm usually in the dining room or living room most days. So I probably need to read some of these tips and take them to heart. But here's some stuff from HGTV.com that I thought might be helpful. And this is written by Tony Hammersley. So here's their 10. This is, you can follow these 10 simple tips to declutter your space. So, 1, purge paper. It's easy to let papers pile up in your home office. Get control of the clutter before it takes over your space. Go through every piece of paper in your office by using the system of 3. Shred, toss it, file it, or take action from it. File important paperwork in a color code filing system. So, I think we're going to get now into your number 2, the color code your filing system. A well-organized filing system is a good indication of functional office space. To organize, separate the filing system into 5 color-coded categories and label each hanging folder according to your needs. Green financial, red medical, orange personal, yellow insurance, and blue house. So that might be a way to keep that all organized. I myself have an accordion folder. I should have brought it with me. I have an accordion folder. It's a really nice one. It's kind of a hard plastic one. It's got the little rubber band around the outside, so it shrinks up. And then when, you know, as the year goes on, it gets puffier. So you release that, and it stands up on its own. And it's a very nice. I have it sectioned out. So I have, you know, banking, credit cards, you know, business. I actually have another organizer where I have, you know, all my billing for my business, etc., and some of the other support documents of my business, you know, place to put all the receipts, that sort of a thing. So I find that insurance is another tab. So that's a good thing. And those are just the active files. Of course, have archival files down in the filing cabinet. But that's like a great way to get that under control. Number 3, create a mail station. This is, you know, more important than you think. Most people don't think, they think email, they don't think paper mail. But this is actually a way things get into your home. In order to maintain control of the paper coming into the home office, create a mail station. Make a folder for incoming and outgoing mail, mail to file, bills, and folder for every family member. As soon as the mail comes in, file it in the mail station. Then once a week, take a few minutes to go through each folder. So, yeah, and if you do have family members who are maybe letting it go, you might want to give them a little help out there. It is easy for things to get caught up in that mail station. It's a good thing, but you do have to make an appointment, either block it out on your calendar or put a reminder on your phone to go through that once a week. So you do work it down because it could end up being a place where, you know, good documents go to die. And next thing you know, you're wondering if you renewed the insurance on your car. Anyway, so again, do go through it once a week. But yes, having a place to put things, to catch things, rather than them having them sit on your dining room table for a month is much better than that. Create a printing station. This is also really important. These days we spend a lot of time printing things out in our own home. Designate a space in your office to house the printer and printer supplies. If you have a wireless printer, it doesn't need to go on your desk. That's one of the great things about wireless. You could be printing anywhere in your house. By placing it in a cabinet or other area of your office, you'll gain much more space on your desk for other items. Yeah, I like just keeping that off in a far-off corner of the house and then just going there when I need to, say, print out my script. 5, store in containers. Store all your office supplies in containers, drawers, baskets, and bins. Putting all these supplies out of sight will give your office a decluttered look. So you don't want that pile of paper clips and rubber bands just sitting there. You can have those in nice, organized little baskets, maybe a little plastic organizer, that sort of a thing. I'm a big fan of the junk drawer organizer. You can get that in a lot of these home stores and possibly the box stores as well. I find that handy because I don't like my paper clips and my rubber bands together. It makes me very unhappy. They're two very different fasteners, so that makes me less than happy. So what I like to do is make sure that those are in separate areas of the junk drawer organizer. Come on in. Number 6, use a label maker. Well, you know me, I'm a huge, huge fan of the label maker. You can invest in a good label maker and label your files, drawers, and boxes for an easy way to organize your office. Whenever someone needs something, you'll know exactly where it is. 7, and this kind of dovetails into that. 7, categorize. organize your files into categories, placing like items together. By doing this, your office will become more functional. For example, look in your mail drawer next time you need stamps. Common categories, stickies, sticky notes, tab stickers, tools, straight cutter, staple remover, hole puncher, budget, checkbook, calculator, bill, calendar, writing tools, markers, pens, pencils, mail, envelopes, stamps, address labels, and labeling, labeler, and label tape. So you'll need some of those. You want to keep those in some sort of order. So keep that a little bit more organized for you. Number 8, organize your books. You can organize books by genre, color, or size, depending on your preference. Color is becoming a huge thing. Organizing books by color. Rosalind, have you ever done that?
Organized books by... I have not. I kind of tend... I'm more of a subject matter person. Too much time in the school library when I was a child. I haven't gone as far as to use the Dewey Decimal System. But, no, I don't do color.
No. No. You like to... You put, like, all the bios together.
I do put all, like, yeah, bios.
All the economic books together.
Correct. All the manufacturing books together. Things like that.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. 9. Create life binders. Organize your most important papers into binders for easy grab and go in case of an emergency. For example, if there is a medical emergency, you could grab your medical binder and have all the information you need immediately. Here are some top binder categories. So they're just giving you some hints here. Medical. This binder will keep your family's medical records, is where your family's medical records are kept. If you ever need to go to a new doctor, if you have a complex medical diagnosis, everything is organized in one spot. Pet. This binder should contain your pet's medical records, shot records, and medications. That's also an important thing to put in your emergency bag. You never know. When you're going to be in an emergency and you're going to have to maybe evacuate your home. And you, when you're going off to a home, people are going to need to know, does your dog have its rabies shot? If you're going to go off to, a temporary shelter, does your dog have its rabies shot? And does it have Bordetella, which is also very important? Or if you have to go to somebody's home, it's good to have that. So, keep that pet information handy, especially the shots. Auto, this binder is designated for all car repairs, maintenance records, and car insurer papers. Manuals. Store your manuals in one place. In this binder, of course, mine has multiple volumes. You can even separate the binder by subcategories, such as appliances, electronics, garden, and house. Of course, you also need to go through that every once in a while. I went through one at my home, and we had like 5 different gas grills in there. And unfortunately, many of these gas grills are long gone because gas grills don't last as long as we want them to. In this case, I was able to purge some of those old manuals.
Well, I kept my old manuals, and then when I just recycled the old toaster oven, I dug out that manual and stuck it with the...
Yeah. And the microwave, I believe, as well.
And the microwave as well, yeah. So I dug out all the appliance manuals.
And gave them rather than threw into the dumpster.
That's
working.
True. I recycled half my appliances.
That's good. That is very good. And then they went on to a place where they would actually be recycled. And house. Store all house-related information here, such as maintenance, pest control, security system, and contact numbers for the handymen that you might, or women, in your life.
Yeah, I actually inherited my house binder from the previous owner. They had a whole bunch of items in the house binder.
And they had also some manuals in there as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you have just one left, and then...
Yeah, and then we'll be on to our guest. We'll take a little break, and we'll be on to our guest. 10. Number 10. Utilize wall space. This is often one step people miss when organizing their office. Use your wall space to hang file systems, calendars, whiteboards, shelving, and more. There's so much more space available when you go vertical. All right. Well, I think we're going to take a brief break. And when we get to the other side of that, we'll have Craig Tomsky with Changing the Game.
When it matters most, our award-winning team of emergency physicians and nurses provides sophisticated care 24 hours a day. Superior emergency care at a moment's notice. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business. You're listening to HuntertonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located at the historic Large House, 119 Main Street, Flemington, New Jersey. The content and views of our hosts do not necessarily reflect the views of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. To contact our station, call 908-782-7115 or email onair@hunterdon-chamber.org. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programs.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Random Walk. I'm your host, Victoria Ann Davis. Joining me now, my guest this evening, author of Changing the Game. Please welcome Craig Tomsky. Good evening.
Hi. Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Hey, glad you could be here and live and in person, which is really makes it fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Craig, tell me a little bit about your book and why you chose to write it.
Well, Changing the Game has been a work that's taken me about five years. Actually, we've been compiling recipes for most of our adult lives, Susan and I. She's sitting over here. But for the most part, I've always tried to impress Susan in the kitchen. And, you know, it's become a way of life. And folks have been coming over to our house for dinners for a long time and saying, you know, you should open a restaurant. And I'm like, that's a tough life. I don't know. I don't know if I can handle that. But maybe someday I'll write a cookbook. And, you know, we have this three-ring binder at home that, you know, must have 100 to 200 recipes in it. And it's broken down by type of meat or, you know, seafood or desserts, side dishes, whatever. And it's just falling apart. And I'm like, I got to get a better way of organizing this. And then the cookbook thing comes into play again. So, you know, over the years, with everybody egging me on saying, you know, you should write a cookbook, I started getting serious about writing my recipes down. And then each recipe has a little anecdote and background, a story that goes with it. I don't think I would have written the book if I couldn't make it different than other cookbooks and wild game cookbooks that are out there. One of the things that sets this book apart is that, you know, I'm a stickler for good quality food and good tasting food. And that started when I was a child. I was very fortunate growing up in a Sicilian-Italian household to have a mother that was a really good cook. And I didn't realize that until I went to Rutgers. And I'm there about 2 weeks, and this is all in the introduction of the book. It describes how I became enlightened as to how good food could be. I remember having a conversation with my mother on the phone, I told her, Mom, this food stinks. Well, if you ever came home once in a while, this has only been here 2 weeks. So I came home, and the first thing she told me how to cook was her meat sauce, which might be my favorite recipe in Chapter 9 to this day. You know, very delicate. It's not her meat sauce. It's her base. Every recipe in here I've modified, you know. Some of it, you know, not only using wild game, but, you know, using some of my science background, such as adjusting the pH of my sauce using baking soda. You know, so you could do that. It'll make the sauce not as acidic, but you'll also get the natural sweetness of the tomatoes, the sweet basil, and all of it coming out, melding, you know, very delicately. And you have a beautiful meat sauce there. Going forward, you know, I came home and I'm like, okay, you know, I got married to Susan, my high school sweetheart. And, you know, we made a hobby of cooking for ourselves. You know, my mother taught us things along the way. And, you know, back then Food Network was becoming popular. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we would watch Food Network. It's probably still the most watched channel in my house when it comes to television. But, you know, I was also fortunate to, you know, be in corporate America, and I ran into some very interesting people. One of them was my first administrative assistant, a little old Italian lady, who, you know, we would trade recipes, and then we would come back and critique each other's recipes and talk about how to make them better. Because I'm a continuous improvement kind of guy. No matter what I do, I'm always striving to make something better. And, you know, I learned a lot from Lucy and, you know, as well as my mother. And then, you know, when I worked at ExxonMobil, which actually I did a nice stint here in Clinton for a couple of years, I got to travel all over the place. And I met people from all over the world, including our own Gulf Coast and, you know, Europe or what have you. And I would always turn the conversation back to food. I loved cultures, learning about different cultures, especially the food. And, you know, growing up here in New Jersey, we have this wonderful melting pot of all these different cultures. A lot of times I don't have to go far. You know, if I want Cuban food, I can go to, Hoboken and visit my daughter, you know, and get some great food. But, you know, a lot of that is reflected in changing the game. So there's your fair share of Italian recipes in here, how to do it with game meat as well as domestic meats. And then I have, you know, a couple of Cajun types of jambalaya and gumbos. I've gotten pretty good with my smoker the last couple of years. All right. So I have some of my own rubs and sauces. I even talk about what woods to use, you know. So what I try to do with Changing the Game is not just give the reader a bunch of recipes, but also tell them how to make their meal outstanding by helping them with keys to the game when it comes to processing your game, not only preparing it. Because really, you know, I have years ago, you know, when we had younger children, you know, and we're trying to make ends meet, you know, it kind of got expensive taking all those deer to the butcher. you know, it could add up. And, you know, I like having game meat throughout the year. You know, for our own family, four deer is good. But then you got every hunter has a list. You know, who else wants venison? And, you know, you're expected to supply those folks. You know, with a little bit here, a little bit there. But for the most part, what I started doing was experimenting with my own butchering of deer, fowl, you know, Canadian geese and other birds. And actually got pretty good at it. I read on it. I read a lot of books. I looked some things up on the internet. But I had friends that were more experienced with me that really taught me some things. And then there was a longtime butcher here in Hunterdon County, John Pearson. He passed away a couple of years ago. He actually did a workshop for folks. And I was away on a business trip, and I missed it. And I called him. I'm like, are you going to have another one? He said, no, but just come down and hang at the shop for a day. I'm like, okay. So I was there the next day. And he's like, all right, here's how we do this. Boom, boom, boom. And you know, with a science background, one of the things I do, not only in my recipes, but, you know, because I consider the kitchen my laboratory, not only with the recipes, but with like the processing, I tried to make observations of what made things different, what made the game more tender, what made the game taste less gamey, you know, and delicious, and you can actually taste the true flavors of the meat. And I wrote those into the first three chapters. I call them my seven keys to the game. And the bottom line is, you know, you can actually taste the difference in the finished product. You know, so, you know, everything I wrote into the first three chapters of Changing the Game is intended to ensure that the reader pulls a package of meat out of their freezer and, you know, can use it in this recipe that they selected they want to make that evening. So, you know, I talk about having a complete game plan, you know, playing sports my entire life. You know, you're talking, you know, you know, sporting good talk, you know, and basically what I try to do is write my game with a lot of double entendre in there. So even my contents is, you know, I have 11 chapters. The first one is developing your game plan, identifying the keys to the game, executing the keys of the game, your equipment locker, knowing your personnel, pre-gaming. There's actually a chapter on mixed drinks. Oh. And wine pairing guidance on there. Thumbs all up. Right. special teams. You know, I talk about what types of flavoring agents other than basic ingredients, such as sausages and rubs and sauces in there, where to use them and how to make them. The big plays is a chapter of using whole cuts of meat, whether it's a steak or a cutlet or a roast. Scheming for success is dealing with the sausages that you make in Chapter 7, or ground meat or cubed meat, and you can make things such as stroganoff or chili or meat sauces out of that. And then sideline happenings, I offer 27 side dishes that would go nicely with these meals. Wow. And I even threw a few of our favorite desserts in there. So all of these things, we've been cooking from scratch our entire lives. We rarely go out, but for the most part, one of the things I did with the Chapter 6 pre-gaming was give some wine pairing guidance to the reader, and then there's even some fun wine trivia in there I threw in. but every recipe in Chapters 8 and 9 also comes with wine pairing guidance and, suggested side dishes. So I try to give the reader an entire game plan. But again, it begins with the end in mind, right? So, you're out there sitting in your tree. You're hungry because you're thinking about food, what you're going to do with this deer that you're going to, harvest. And, this is how I wrote the book. You're sitting in my tree thinking, I got to write that down, when I get back to my house. So, but changing the game, I think, it differs because you will see, if you butcher with the advice that I give in the first three chapters, you will see a difference in flavor and tenderness.
Oh, that's great.
And then I also, as part of my game plan for the reader, basically break down the thought process of, well, where do I start if I'm going to butcher my own deer? It's not for everybody. A lot of people don't have their space. I don't really need a lot of space to butcher a deer, but if you read it, you'll get an understanding of, how much space do you need. For example, when I talk about breaking the animal down, like a large deer, a large game or mid-sized game, I talk about rough cuts versus final cuts. And the rough cuts we do in the garage, and that's basically deboning the carcass, all right? And once you debone that, you have a means. We use big stainless steel baker trays or stainless steel bowls to bring those rough cuts to get them chilled into your meat freezer or your extra refrigerator. Or if it's cold outside, you could just leave them outside for a few minutes to an hour. But what you want to do is chill those cuts, and then what you can do is make those final cuts in a clean environment such as your kitchen. So, we have designated areas in our kitchen where the other family members know to stay out of while I'm, butchering. I'm usually in one corner, but for the most part, I tried, again, to take the reader from beginning to end, from the harvest all the way through dessert when it comes to, a complete experience with wild game food.
Wow. Well, that sounds great. So it's really very comprehensive.
Yeah, it's 288 pages. It took me, it was fun writing it, because, I have a dry sense of humor. And I guess a lot of folks in Jersey will get it, but I don't know how it'll
the
rest of the country. There's a lot of pun in there. Like I said, double entendre. I think I tried to keep the reader entertained with the anecdotes or the backstory behind each meal. I wanted to make it a fun read because, I've read a lot of different cookbooks out there, and it's like, okay, just get me to the recipe, but I want the reader to enjoy their experience.
That's great. That is great. And that's one of the things with me. I am a big reader of cookbooks. Read them like, most people read novels. So
that's good.
So I want a cookbook I want the recipes, but I want to read some text. I want to know why the chef is choosing to do what they're doing.
Yep.
So I think that's a really great way. And this is obviously something that's maybe very different from other cookbooks on your shelf.
Yeah. And again, if I couldn't put something out there that was different than the other ones, I probably would have not done that. I actually, in my search to publish the book, had a brief meeting with a book consultant, and she came back to me and said, you don't not only have an excellent idea for a cookbook, but you have a niche book. So it's two books in one. It's a cookbook and a niche book because it really, there's not a lot of books that tell you how to butcher wild game and make it taste great. There's a lot of books out there that tell you how to butcher the game, but I'm giving you the keys to the game, how to execute them, and then, when you go to your freezer and you want to make this meal, you're going to have that cut of meat in there so you can make that meal.
That's great. No, that's fascinating. So are there benefits to eating wild game versus a more traditionally farmed and processed food?
Well, you know what? I'm not going to get into the science, and there's all kinds of, you know, history on that. Of course, I'm guessing the wild game is a little lower in cholesterol than maybe some farmed food. But, you know, we enjoy across the board. I have a degree in environmental science from Rutgers. I went to school at Cook College in New Brunswick, which is part of Rutgers University. It's a school of environmental science and agriculture. And I did have a couple of food science courses. And, you know, the bottom line is if you eat in a wide variety, you eat in moderation, you're going to stay relatively healthy. But, yes, the game meat definitely is more lean than some of your farm-raised animals. But, you know, one of the things we found to serving good food really enjoying it is, number one, it keeps the family together. Our kids want to come to dinner, to the dinner table. So we've been eating together, you know, for our entire lives. And I thank Susan for that. Even when we're on the lacrosse field, I'm out there coaching with the kids. We'd come home. The other three are waiting for us at the dinner table, you know, at dark 30, you know, when you're getting in the door. So that's a big thing, you know, doing things. The processing and the cooking makes things fun. My kids are constantly trying to outdo me in the kitchen, you know. You know, that's part of it. And the other thing was return on investment. I talked about, it costs, the money can add up when you have all these deer to butcher. So you're saving some money. And, you know, the satisfaction you get out of, you know, doing it all yourself is unparalleled.
That's amazing. Yeah, it's great to have that food tradition in your family. We're half Italian.
All right.
Yeah. In fact, one quarter Sicilian. So.
All right. Yeah, good.
And so we have a lot of food memories. We also have food memories from our Lithuanian side as well. People who are good in the kitchen spent a lot of time there. And certainly our grandfather, who's Sicilian, he was a very big into cooking, spent a lot of time in the kitchen. He had worked as a sous chef in an area restaurant. So he had a very good grasp of that. And he so my fondest childhood memories are him, you know, cooking on a weekend, like usually a Saturday, and making, you know, things like seafood fried diablo and some amazing dishes.
And hanging out with them, spending that family time.
Right.
The other thing is, you know, I felt obligated to write the book because one of the things I'm dealing with, and I talk to all different people, you know, when I'm working in corporate America, is that a lot of the traditions aren't being passed down to the current generation or the last generation. Yeah. You know, so I'm hoping folks will buy this book to, use it as a mechanism to keep their families together, spend time together, whether they're out in the field hunting or, you know, they're processing or they're in the kitchen cooking.
Wow. Yeah, and that's great. And that's just a way to bring people together. And one of the cool things, you know, I mean, there was a lot that was in the last 18 months that has been unfortunate in the world. But one of the good things is it has given people an opportunity to come home, to be at home, spend time at home, and prepare food at home. They're almost, you know, being forced to do that. Yeah. But it's good for them because they're, you know, rediscovering the kitchen, rediscovering how to cook, and spending time with their family as well.
Yeah. I have a 23-year-old at home saying she's never leaving.
So. Is that because of the food? Or?
Of course. And her, she likes hanging with her mom. They're like best friends.
So getting back to hunting a little bit, are there ecological benefits from getting food from the wild, from harvesting from the wild?
Yeah, you know, hunting is probably the one of the most effective forms of conservation of wildlife there is. The state of New Jersey does a great job with their conservation efforts, and hence the population explosion of deer. You know, you have wild turkey population explosion. You know, you recently had black bear, and now coyote is like all over the place. Not that we want to deal with those guys, but you know, they, you know, back in, like, I think it was around 1920, deer were technically extinct, and the state brought them in. They brought in deer from Michigan and Pennsylvania, I think. So we get some pretty good big deer here, and you know, your return on investment's great. So if you shoot a mature animal, you're getting plenty of meat out of it. But return on investment is going all around. So the hunter, you know, obviously benefits because they're getting fresh meat. The state is getting, you know, their tax burden alleviated by the fees associated with licensings and permits. And you have farmers out there that, you know, need to control deer populations or else they'll just decimate their crops. The farm I hunt now, the fella doesn't even plant soybean anymore because they just mow it down to 2-3 inch mm-hmm. stubs. Mm-hmm. You know, so he's strictly corn and hay and, you know, maybe some alfalfa, which they have their way with also. But for the most part, you know, ecologically, you know, culling the herd as a hunter, you know, you're helping the other wildlife where, you know, that rely on certain plants and habitat to survive that the deer might just mow down. So, you know, hunting is a good thing when it, you know, for the environment because it helps keep the deer in check. Same thing with geese. You know, I do a lot of goose hunting, and in New Jersey in September you can shoot like 15 a day. The problem with that is you just can't go to those corporate lawns to get them. But for the most part, I really enjoy you know, seeing that I'm contributing to not only my family's well-being, but the local society around me when I hunt.
Wow. So there are a lot of benefits, and it can be economic, they can be environmental, they can be a lot of things. Yeah. Wow. That's pretty impressive. It is really an interesting thing. And so what types of game do you talk about in the book?
So the way I wrote the recipes, you know, you have a couple of recipes for fowl. And waterfowl is going to taste somewhat different. And I'm very sorry. I forgot a package of my twice-smoked goose jerky for you. I was rushing out of the house to get here on time. And, you know, Sue remembered everything. And I had one thing to bring with the goose jerky. for the most part, we have a couple of waterfowl recipes. You know, you have gumbo, you have my jerky, you have grilled duck or goose breasts. I have mostly venison or large game recipes for the readers. A lot of the recipes can be interchangeable. You'll have a difference in maybe a little bit of flavor or sweetness. For example, like I made my venison chili with pronghorn, and, you know, it was like, whoa, this is a little sweeter. You know, she's like, did you put sugar in it? I'm like, no. You know, the other things, like I have a pronghorn Milanese recipe in there, and I make it with venison cutlets. It's great, and I'll take mm-hmm. either one of them over veal any day.
Wow.
The recipes are written for the most part to be used with different types of large game. If they're for large or medium game, you'll have some, you know, recipes for pork, like wild boars, you know, a good natural resource. And being part Italian, you know, you'll know that they're allowed to hunt wild boar and actually sell them because they're such an invasive species there.
Yeah, they can be quite dangerous actually in certain parts of the country. So yeah. So important.
So yeah, so we try to give you the whole gamut, and in fact we have some recipes. You know, I have something called shingali and fennelescent stew. Actually, we just made that Sunday night, and it's shingali is wild boar in Italian, but I didn't fresh out a wild boar, so you don't have any here in New Jersey. And I haven't been on a hunt in a while, but we use venison, cubed venison, and it just came out phenomenal.
Wow. So you're able to interchange quite a bit.
Yes.
Yeah. And so have you actually consumed, I know we Italians, we cook every part of the pig except the squeal, but I think I may have consumed squeal on a couple of occasions. So I don't know.
So I have this saying, I don't eat organs. Okay. And that's one of the keys to changing the game. If it's not red, it doesn't go in the package. I talk to the reader about glands, where to find them on the animal, what they'll look like, and how to get rid of them. We'll do a lot of the trimming of the fat. If I want fat in a recipe, you know, usually like with the ground meat, I introduce some pork shoulder during the grinding process of it. You know, I want the good fat. You know, different portions of fat from different types of fat come from different portions of the animal. So I usually recommend, like, you know, pork shoulder or what, or lean piece of pork, you know, to grind in with your meat. So, but yeah, getting rid of the fat, the silver skin, all of that stuff are key, some of my keys to the game.
Oh, great. So that's, oh, that's, that would be interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that would change the taste quite a bit.
By all means. It's a big influence on the flavor of the game. And in fact, you know, if I have a deer that I want to give to a family member, like my brother-in-law's or some, my daughter, you know, I text them, hey, you want a deer? They ask me who's going to do the butchering. and I'm like, well, it's before work and I have to take it to the butcher. Like, no thanks. That's how much of a difference it makes. Because a lot of times the butchers, you know, they're processing. That's your business.
Right.
And they're processing deer. And, you know, they'll hang the deer and they'll, you know, take a hind quarter and they'll run it across the bandsaw. Well, as that bandsaw is going, it's smearing the marrow, the glands, all of that stuff across the meat. And your influence, and then they package it and wrap it. So now you have that influence of that flavor. And you might not want that flavor. You know, sometimes the bone marrow, you want to use bone marrow to flavor your meals. Not with venison, not with maybe with some other game.
Okay? Interesting. I had not realized that.
Yeah. You know, so that's the difference. You know, that's another key to the game is, you know, deboning everything here.
Wow. Wow. So you're doing that right off the bat when you're butchering your own.
Right. And typically, you know, it takes me, I got it down to like 3.5. If I'm doing a deer, it's about 3.5 hours. You know, and that includes cleanup, you know, sanitization of the garage, you know, the work surfaces in the kitchen, things like that, and packaging and labeling. So fowl, you know, typically what I recommend for birds is you breast them and take the legs, you know, and you'll be pleasantly surprised how much, you know, that changes the flavor, because you're not, you know, roasting an entire bird and getting all of that soft tissue flavor into the meat when, you know, or your broth or your sauce when you're doing it.
Okay, so it'll give you more of a traditional flavor or more less
like
of that.
Like chicken, yeah.
Yeah,
it'll tastes like chicken. It tastes like chicken.
Yeah, so you'll get something that's a little bit more familiar tasting, I guess.
You can say that, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we had my upland birds and wine sauce. That was a recipe my mother introduced to us. And, you know, we never had any measurements for it. And I remember for the longest time, you know, it had mushrooms in it, had water chestnuts. So, you know, I remember putting in like condensed, like Campbell's soup, like was it cream of mushroom? Was it cream of chicken? For the longest time, we were trying to cream a mushroom and it wasn't working. And I'm like, you know, I got to try to cream a chicken. And, you know, it got the flavor profile closer to what I remembered. And you know, we ended up kept on experimenting. None of these recipes are first time things. Mm-hmm. Everything, you know, was gyration after gyration after gyration to get it to where I wanted it with the ingredients. And the funny thing was when we tried the chicken, cream of chicken soup, we got closer. And then like a week later, ironically, this is after my mother passed away, I was visiting my sister up in Cedar Grove and she goes, oh, I found mommy's file cabinets, file recipe boxes in the basement.
Ah.
You know, all handwritten, smudged, no measurements. You know, half of it. You know, we found the chicken and wine sauce thing. I'm like, cream of chicken. Yeah, I told you. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that was like a treasure trove for us to find. You know, and a lot of the times, the running joke throughout the book is you know, that older generation didn't measure anything.
Wow.
You know, and and it's like, you know, a pinch of this and, you know, throw it in when it smells right or add it at the, you know, wait a minute, who knows when it smells right? So, but the funny thing about that is, you know, being, you know, having a science background, one of the things I recommend for folks to do is measure things, measure your ingredients out. I learned that a while ago, back in the mid 90s, I had a cookbook. And, you know, I didn't measure. And I'm like, this isn't coming out like it did the last time. Why? So I learned to measure things. And again, you know, you have to be cognizant cognizant of the observations in your work or your experimentation to make be able to understand where you're having those deviations. So I do have chapter 4 in here, some of the equipment. I recommend the use of measuring cups, measuring spoons. You know, I talk about liquid measure versus solid measure a little bit, and making sure you use level, you know, teaspoons or tablespoons or what have you. And, you know, because I don't like the inconsistency. When I make something, I want it to knock it out of the park and enjoy it to the utmost.
Right, right. When, you know, when people are producing on large scales, you know, like bakeries or something like that, you know, they're very precise. In their case, they're using a lot of weight. They're using, you know, measuring with weight a lot of times. And it's because they need that precision, because when you're making, you know, tons and tons of cookies, most of us are making one little batch of cookies. You know, probably a little bit here, a little bit there isn't going to make a big difference. But when you're making, you know, hundreds of cookies, you definitely need to be very precise, because a little bit off could be quite a bit off.
It's quality control. It really is. It's for me, it's a quality control thing. You want to buy the book and just, you know, throw in ingredients. You know, I do encourage folks to try their own thing. So,
yeah, experiment. Yeah,
yeah, sure. Sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think cooking is very much a folk tradition, you know, just like folk dancing, folk music, something like that. It's all about, you know, we share and we are communicating, even when we're just putting a dish in front of somebody, we are communicating.
Yeah.
And so it's important to kind of learn, and we've, of course, learned, you were talking about finding your mother's recipe. I remember when Rosalind first wanted to learn how to cook tomato sauce and sat down with our mother and said, well, okay, what do I do? And she started running down the steps, and mom said, well, you know, it's going to smell a certain way when those onions are ready, when it's ready for the aroma.
Oh, yeah.
When you smell
the aroma, you'll know. Yeah.
Right? And I've done my mother's meat sauce once where I've overdone the onions. And I'm like, twice. Once I burned them to the bottom of the pan because I got sidetracked doing other things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a good multitasker. But for the most part, I got to tell you, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I try to explain things as much as possible in the instruction section. It's changing the game so people can have a pleasant dining experience.
Well, that's great. That's great. So, if people wanted to take, if we wanted people to take away just one thing from this interview with a sportsman or sportswoman, what would you want them to take away?
There's no right way or wrong way, you know, processing the game or cooking a specific meal. Do what, you know, floats your boat. And I do have a quote in here after the introduction. And basically, you know, I've been called a perfectionist in my life, you know, and really I'm not. And I've come to realize over the years, you know, what we perceive as perfection is rarely attainable. But if you continuously strive for excellence, you'll be pleasantly surprised as to how close you can get to your end game. And, you know, that's what I would like the readers to do. You know, you prepare for hunting. It's a lot of hard work. It's a work ethic kind of sport, just like many other sports. You put a lot of time in, a lot of energy, a lot of effort. And, you know, you should be able to optimize your reward. And I felt by writing Changing the Game, readers would be able to do that from beginning to end of the process.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's just an amazing thing to connect. You know, I'm a gardener. Yeah. I have chickens. I have pet chickens. So,
she
you know,
chickens. We just got the third Chesapeake Gray Retriever puppy. So yeah, we're done with the animals for now.
Yeah. You know, it's great to be able to connect your land and your food and your cooking all together. It's a special thing.
Well, I used to be a stickler. I used to grow my tomatoes from seed in the greenhouse,
mm-hmm.
and you know, there'd be the 35 tomato plants, and I'd harvest them, and I'd make the sauces and batch, and I'd can them, and we'd have them all winter long. You know, the whole goal was to have at least 26 jars for at least every other week.
Every
sauce. Do it. Yeah.
That's great. That's hilarious. Okay, see, some of you do think like me. I'm not the only one.
So once again, the name of your book is Changing the Game.
Changing the Game.
Changing the Game. There you go. All right. Oh, she's gonna deliver it to the camera. There you go. Changing the Game. And you have a website, right? It's actually, it's a little bit different than just Changing the Game. It's changingthewildgame.com?
Changingthewildgame.com. Yeah, Changing the Game was taken. My website is changingthewildgame.com. You can follow me on Instagram at changingthewildgame and also on Facebook at changingthegame, the wild game. So, books for sale online, pretty much everywhere fine books are sold, including my website, changingthewildgame.com. One of our other local businesses, Jim Flynn's Truck Repair up in Glen Gardner on Route 31, is selling copies for me too. So
all right.
I appreciate that, Jim. I'm a longtime customer of his.
Oh.
And for those of you who don't know, Jim's shop sells guns and ammo. He doesn't do truck repair anymore. thank you for that. On sale now.
Well, thank you for being a part of the show tonight once again.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having us.
So thank you, Craig. Craig Tomsky, Changing the Game. And we're going to take a few seconds for a break, and we'll be back after this.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on 100 in Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@100-chamber.org.
When it matters most, our award-winning team of emergency physicians and nurses provides sophisticated care 24 hours a day. Superior emergency care at a moment's notice. 100 in Healthcare, your full circle of care. 100 in Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. 100 in Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call 100 in Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.100inhealthcare.org.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
Hi, I'm Oz Davis, and welcome back to Random Walk. Just quickly, history was made today when Jeff Bezos soared to the edge of space in his Blue Origin launch. At least he is somebody who put his money where his mouth is and took the first human flight of his Blue Origin New Shepard spaceship up to the stratosphere, or I guess beyond the stratosphere. I mean, how does that all work? I'm not an astronomer. Right, and then it's... Yeah, because I think I learned that someday in science where they had the different parts of I used to know that. I don't anymore. That was a long time ago. But anyway, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos blasted to the edge of space. He spent a few minutes outside the Earth's atmosphere, and then on Tuesday with the first crewed flight from his firm Blue Origin, he said it was the best day ever.
I heard him say it because he had that sound feed going.
So I imagine it could be. I don't know, but perhaps.
Well, maybe because it was my birthday. That's why.
That's what it was. Well, the milestone launch in the modern commercial space race comes on the 52nd anniversary of Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin's moon landing in 1969. Though the spacefaring landscape has evolved by giant leaps since then, as billionaires have emerged as the key players driving the new race into the cosmos. Bezos, who holds the title of the richest man in the world per Bloomberg data, has said that the spaceflight will fulfill a lifelong dream. He is also curious of how it will change him. Bezos revealed what astronauts spoke about as they were in the capsule ahead of the launch, saying he told his crewmates that the flight is not just about adventure, but also the start of something big. And I guess he's onto something there.
I'd say.
What we're doing is the first step of something big, and I know what it feels like. I did it nearly three decades ago, with Amazon, Bezos said. Big things start small, but you can tell when you're onto something, and this is important. We're going to build a road to space so that our kids and their kids can build a future, and we need to do that. We need to do that to solve the problems here on Earth, Bezos added. This is not about escaping Earth. The billionaire said that Earth is the only good planet in our solar system. And we've sent robotic probes to all of them. When you go to space and see how fragile it is, you want to take care of it even more, and that's what it's about, Bezos said. He also estimated that Blue Origin has approached some $100 million in private ticket sales already. While building the space infrastructure will take decades, Bezos said this is how it starts. And I guess that's true. We've seen Richard Branson and his successful flight, what was that, about 10 days ago? He was the first one to do it, and now Bezos. Eventually Elon Musk will go up there, but I think he's waiting till it's ultra safe or something. I don't know. anyway, just to quickly before we exit.
Yes.
Are we done?
Close, but we're still on.
Oh, okay. So Wally Funk, she was originally trained as an astronaut back in the day in the Mercury 13 mission that never was, I guess, because it was women and they wouldn't allow women into space or
AKA
whatever.
AKA Ladies Night.
Yeah.
In space.
Ladies Night. She went up. She was one of the four who went up, and she's been waiting a long time to finally get up there, the emotional 82-year-old said after the space flight. I didn't do dolls. I did outside stuff. I flew airplanes. She trained with in the 1960s, but they were only sending men into space, and she called the trip into space wonderful and a great time. The pioneer for women in aerospace all said that she is not done with space travel yet, saying, I want to go again fast. Because, well, there's not enough time. She's 82, so she better hurry up.
Yeah, but that's hope for all these people over 80. You can still accomplish your dreams even if you are over 80.
I guess that's your takeaway.
There you go.
That's your takeaway. So Jeff Bezos into space successfully went up. He came down, took about 10 minutes, and I think we're almost done. So I'm going to say happy birthday, Victoria.
Why, thank you. Thanks for joining in. Join us on Random Walk tonight, and thanks to our guest, Craig Tomsky, author of Changing the Game. We'll be back
in 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks. We'll be back in August. Have a great rest of July, and we'll see you.
Thank you. Have a great night.
Good night, everyone.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
Well, I would say that's not a characterization we're making from here.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, when asked if the Texas Democrats who fled the state to avoid voting on a bill caused a super spreader event at the White House, Psaki continues by saying breakthrough cases do happen.
We certainly understand there will be breakthrough cases. Even vaccines that are incredibly effective are not foolproof.
At least six of those state representatives have tested positive for COVID-19, along with a White House staffer. Investors in the buying mood after yesterday's big sell-off, the Dow gaining 550 points to close at 34,511. Game 6 of the NBA Finals set to take place tonight in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The Bucks looking to put an end to the Phoenix Suns season as the Bucks lead that series 3-2. You're listening to USA Radio News.
When thinking about life insurance, my accident reinforced you never know what tomorrow might bring. That's why I reached out to AccuQuote. AccuQuote helps people find a life insurance policy that meets their needs. Since 1986, they've helped millions of folks save up to 60% on their life insurance by comparing the rates and features of dozens of top-rated life insurance products. A healthy 50-year-old non-smoker can buy $500,000 of 10-year level term for less than $45 a month. A 60-year-old under $120 a month. Longer or permanent terms are available. Even if you already own life insurance, you really need to check out my friends at AccuQuote. Don't worry about health issues. Remember, they help me. As a pastor, I'm concerned about your soul and helping you to make sure your family is taken care of. Life insurance is more affordable now than ever, so don't make them wish you'd made that call. 877-437-4781.